Martial Court, Part 2. The case of Martin versus Hunter's lessee, which arose out of the case Hunter versus Martin, coming up from the Court of Appeals of Virginia, concerned land titles in Virginia and was especially notable for the members of the court because Chief Justice John Marshall himself had an interest. Marshall, like other leading men of Virginia in his day, invested quite a bit of his property in land titles in the West, and in fact, this had been a tradition in Virginia among the landed gentry since before the Revolution. In 1763, King George III had, at the end of the Seven Years' War, issued an edict that it was actually called the Royal Proclamation of 1763, that from that point on, until further notice, no subject of his should settle west of the Appalachian Peaks. And so this offended wealthy people from basically all the country, all the colonies in North America at the same time. Marshall continued dabbling in land titles well into the early national period, and he and his brother were part of the syndicate that was claiming land in what is now Kentucky, essentially, besides land in the Northern Neck. But this case, Martin versus Hunter's lessee, arose from land speculation in the Northern Neck. And the question was the relationship between the United States Supreme Court and the top courts in each of the individual states. During the ratification contest, some Federalists, including George Mason, had complained about the potential structure of the federal court system, Mason repeatedly saying that the Congress might easily allow wealthy people to be favored by the system. In other words, he thought that if there were inferior federal courts and if they could stage trials, the fact that they were distant from some parts of the country would favor wealthy people who, unlike the poor and unlike the average Joe, would be able to afford to take witnesses to a distant court seat and to travel themselves there, to have local counsel represent them, and so on. So at one point, James Madison actually said that, well, the experiment could be tried of having a federal government without inferior courts. And of course, that didn't go very far. But in Martin versus Hunter's lessee, there was an appeal from a decision of the top court in Virginia, and Marshall recused himself because of his personal interest in the case. So in that case, his right-hand man, Justice Joseph Story, wrote for the court. Story is a very important figure in American legal history for more than one reason. I mean, he would be a significant person if all he had done was write the court's decision in the case of Martin versus Hunter's lessee, but he was also responsible for the court's decision in Prigg versus Pennsylvania, a very important slavery-related case later on, and he was, for a long time, the only law professor at Harvard. So he trained many of the leading lights of early national antebellum legal practice and legal thinking in the Northeast. Story said for the court that Section 25 of the Judiciary Act of 1789, the one that had set up the federal court system in the first place, was constitutional. Section 25 was the one that empowered, or purported at least to empower, the Supreme Court to take appeals from the top courts of individual states. Story's reasoning was that the Constitution intended a kind of pyramid of courts with the U.S. Supreme Court at the top. And so the Supreme Court sent a writ of certiorari back to the Virginia Court of Appeals. The Virginia Court of Appeals at that point refused to cooperate anyway. They refused to send the paperwork necessary for the Supreme Court to take the appeal. And their reasoning was that the U.S. Supreme Court was at the head of the federal legal system, but the Virginia legal system, the Virginia court system, was a coordinate court system, not a subordinate one. And so it did not recognize that the U.S. Supreme Court was entitled to give it an order. The second, and actually equally significant and equally irksome to Virginia Republicans, important case of the second part of the Marshall Court was in McCulloch versus Maryland. McCulloch versus Maryland, coming soon after Martin versus Hunter's lessee, and in the context of 1819, was bound to annoy Virginia Republicans and Republicans more generally. 1819, of course, is an epical year for more than one reason in American history. 1819 was also the year of two other important events. One was the Panic of 1819, an economic crash that was especially severely felt in the Middle States. And besides that, 1819 was the year that contention first arose over the question of admitting Missouri to the state, to the Union as a state. In McCulloch versus Maryland, the court would be deciding the question of the extent of Congress's powers. So typically, if one takes a course in constitutional law, one begins with Marbury versus Madison, which is, of course, the Supreme Court's dispositive statement on the question whether federal courts have the power of judicial review. And then comes McCulloch versus Maryland, which is about the extent of Congress's powers. The issue here in McCulloch was whether Congress had power to charter the Second Bank of the United States. The First Bank of the United States had ceased to exist in 1811. And as we've seen, in 1791, when the matter was pending first in Congress and then in the cabinet, first James Madison in the House of Representatives and then Thomas Jefferson in the cabinet had argued that the Congress did not have authority to charter a bank. And Madison's reasoning was that, first of all, there had been discussion in the Philadelphia Convention of the question of empowering Congress to charter corporations, and Congress had not been given this power. So that seemed to lead to the inference that, well, Congress didn't have this power. Second thing was that there was nothing in the Constitution certainly saying that Congress could charter a bank. And the 10th Amendment to the Constitution indicated that Congress only had the powers that were granted by the Constitution. In fact, in the ratification process, again, as we've seen, the Federalists commonly said that the Congress was only going to have the powers that were expressly granted. That was the word that was used over and over by Virginia's governor, Edmund Randolph, later the first U.S. Attorney General, in the Virginia Ratification Convention. So Madison argued that there was no power of Congress to charter a bank in 1791. Madison essentially lent his argument to Thomas Jefferson, the Secretary of State, who famously repeated it in an epical state paper, which remains today the foremost statement on the question of the full extent of Congress's powers from a state's rights point of view. On the other hand, Alexander Hamilton, the Treasury Secretary and the father of the First Bank of the United States, argued that, well, it's true there was nothing expressly stated in the Constitution about a power of Congress to charter a corporation, notably a bank corporation, but, Hamilton said, everybody conceded that there were some powers that were implicitly granted, and he took a very broad view of the Necessary and Proper Clause, which is at the end of Article 1, Section 8, and said that certainly if it's not expressly stated that Congress can charter a bank, well, it might well find that it was necessary and proper to charter a bank in furtherance of its power to regulate weights and measures, to coin money, to regulate trade with foreign countries, to regulate trade with the Indians, and its general supervisory authority over the economy. By 1811, when that 20-year charter was up for renewal, the Republicans were in control of Congress, and the Republican vice president, formerly Hamilton's chief antagonist in New York politics, George Clinton, was very happy to cast the deciding vote, killing the Bank of the United States. But at the end of the War of 1812, President Madison had made clear that he would be happy to see the bank resuscitated, and so in 1816, a bill was passed, which he signed, chartering a second Bank of the United States, once again with a 20-year charter, once again with Congress ensuring that the United States government would be one of the major shareholders. So the fact that the Federalists and now the Republicans, including the Republican President and the Republican Treasury Secretary, favored having Congress charter banks might seem to have resolved the issue, but there were some state legislatures in which Republicans had not been placated by this volte-face of Hamilton and company. And one of those was Ohio, where they simply banned activity by out-of-state banks within their territory. Another one was Maryland, where Maryland established a prohibitive tax on the operations of the branch of the United Bank of the United States that was to operate in Maryland. Some people have thought this was a test case, that is, that was set up by the parties with the intention of getting an authoritative statement from the Supreme Court on the question whether Congress had power to charter a bank. We can't know that for certain, but the indications are that it may well have been a test case. John Marshall, in his decision upholding the constitutionality of the bank, borrowed heavily from Alexander Hamilton's 1791 memorandum for George Washington in favor of the constitutionality of the bank. This was not a new departure for Marshall, who also had borrowed heavily from Hamilton in his other most important decision, the one in Marbury versus Madison, where he essentially cribbed from Federalist number 78. In Marshall's opinion for the court, in McCulloch versus Maryland, he rejected the Jeffersonian argument that was made by the attorney he referred to repeatedly as, quote, counsel for Maryland. Counsel for Maryland is never named in the decision of the court, but his name was Luther Martin, and Marshall essentially lectured him on the proceedings in the Philadelphia Convention of 1787. This calls to mind the old apothegm that the Supreme Court is not final because it's infallible. It's infallible because it's final. In other words, if the court misstates history, well, there's nothing you can do to correct it. And so Luther Martin, who was himself an active member of the Philadelphia Convention, had to listen to John Marshall, who had not been there, read a long opinion lecturing him essentially on what had happened in the Philadelphia Convention. So, what had Martin argued in front of the court? Well, Martin had argued to the court that the states created the federal government, that they gave it only a few specified powers, that the power to charter a bank was not among those powers, and so essentially this led to the 10th Amendment conclusion that the Congress didn't have power to charter a bank. Here, Marshall seems intentionally to have mischaracterized Martin's position as that the state governments created the federal government. Now, this is a very common way that Federalists mischaracterized the Republican argument about the nature of the federal Constitution. They commonly said that, no, everybody knows the state governments didn't create the federal government, it was the people who created the federal government, when Republicans never said the state governments created the federal government. What they said was that the states created the federal government. And, of course, Marshall knew perfectly well that it was the states acting through the ratification conventions that created the federal government. This is what Article 7 of the Constitution says. It says that the Constitution will go into effect among the ratifying states as soon as 9 states have ratified. So it was the states ratifying the Constitution that put the Constitution into effect. And this is what Martin said, that the states created the federal government. But Marshall was not going to be the last major figure who thus mischaracterized the Republican position, which was also the original Virginia Federalist position on the nature of the federal government. So, Marshall based his argument after rejecting the counter-argument about the constitutionality of the bank charter that had been granted to the Second Bank of the United States. Marshall also made an affirmative argument basing constitutionality of the bank on 2 contentions. Number one, he said, well, a long time has passed since this issue first came up, and somehow the fact of a passage of a long time seemed to him to indicate that the question had been settled, which, however much one thinks about the Burkean idea that the passage of time and the habituation of people to fixed institutions is a good thing, still it shouldn't have much to do with interpreting a written constitution, which is written, of course, because its meaning is supposed to be fixed. Anyway, the second contention that Marshall made was that the Necessary and Proper Clause gave Congress a very broad latitude in deciding what would be useful to it in implementing its specified powers. So Marshall said there had been a bank for years, everyone conceded that a bank was needed, and the necessary and proper clause did not always require that provision be strictly necessary in order to be constitutional, but Congress would have a broad latitude in deciding what kinds of measures were useful to it in implementing its specified powers. This is the classic broad reading of the Constitution. So I said before that Jefferson's state paper, his memorandum for George Washington in 1791, is the classic strict construction or states' rights, or I would say just constitutionalist good faith way of reading the Constitution. On the other hand, the classic liberal, broad, or bad faith way of reading the Constitution is to be found in John Marshall's opinion in McCulloch versus Maryland. When James Madison, back in Virginia in retirement, heard about and saw Marshall's opinion for the court in McCulloch versus Maryland, he wrote that if the people had known when it was depending before them that the Constitution was going to be read this way, they would never have ratified it. In response to McCulloch versus Maryland, as in response to Martin versus Hunter's lessee, several Virginia judges, including Virginia's chief judge, Spencer Roan, who coincidentally or not was a son-in-law of Patrick Henry, took to the newspapers. And in the newspapers, they wrote a series of blasts at the court for its decision in McCulloch versus Maryland. Roan and others said that Virginia had been told repeatedly Congress would only have the powers that were, quote, expressly, unquote, granted. This was what Edmund Randolph, the governor of Virginia and one of the three chief spokesmen for the Federalists in the Virginia Ratification Convention, this was what Randolph had assured his fellow Virginians was the case. If, like James Madison, one takes the authentic meaning of the Constitution to have been that which was stated by its proponents in the ratification contest, then special deference is to be paid to the public and repeated statements of the governor of Virginia in the ratification convention of that largest, most populous state in 1788. Marshall, reading these blasts, wrote to friends and said a mighty storm was brewing in Virginia, and it's loosed a most powerful rain indeed upon the heads of the judges. So he answered them in a series of editorials. But interestingly, although he was from Richmond, and although he was the Chief Justice and a Randolph, that is, although he was at the center of the Federalist elite in Richmond, he could not find a Virginia paper to publish them in. The fact that they were published in Maryland meant that nobody noticed them until 1969, when Marshall's editorials were gathered in a handy volume. It's, of course, difficult to find. Maybe you can get it on Amazon, but it makes an interesting debate, the bound version of Roan and other Virginians, on one hand blasting the court, and then Marshall trying, I think, rather meekly or rather weakly to defend the court. One might have thought that Marshall would be a bit embarrassed by his performance here. I actually asked my friend Kent Neumeyer, the Marshall biographer, emeritus professor at the University of Connecticut, whether he was familiar with any instance in which John Marshall had cited the record of one of the ratification conventions in his opinions for the Supreme Court, and Kent told me no, he didn't think that had ever happened. And there's good reason for that. If you read the ratification convention record in volumes 8 through 10 of the documentary history of ratification of the Constitution, in which Marshall was an active participant in Virginia, and in which the Federalists leadership, including Randolph, but also George Nicholas, repeatedly said that the Constitution was going to be read one way, with the necessary and proper clause basically requiring or empowering Congress to do only those things that were actually necessary and proper, not to take a very broad reading of its powers and to do things that were two and three removes away from necessary. On the one hand, and then if you read Marshall's opinion from McCulloch on the other hand, it's quite embarrassing. So it's not surprising that Marshall wouldn't have said anything about this in his opinions for the court. The third truly significant decision of the last period of the Marshall Court was in the case of Barron versus Baltimore. Here we have Chief Justice Marshall at the very end of his career writing an opinion about a matter that arose in the city of Baltimore, and a very uncharacteristic outcome is reached by Marshall. There has in fact been a debate among scholars in recent years over the question, why did Marshall reach this conclusion? And one obvious answer that suggests itself is, well, because it was the obvious right conclusion. But then again, if you're familiar with Marshall's other major cases, you might not think that that was the first answer that should come to mind. But anyway, the case of Barron versus Baltimore involved a fellow named Barron who owned a pier in the port of Baltimore. And of course, Baltimore, Maryland is the chief seaport in the Chesapeake Bay. So it was always a busy seaport, and certainly in 1833, when this case was decided, remained the main seaport in Chesapeake Bay. Barron owned a pier in Baltimore's Bay, and he claimed that Baltimore, the city, had ruined his pier by regrading its roads. So they had problems with water runoff in the city of Baltimore in case of rain, and what they decided to do was to regrade their roads and to channel the rainwater so that they didn't constantly have to refinish the roads after heavy rains. But the unforeseen consequence here was that the new pattern of runoff from the city of Baltimore into the bay meant that silt built up around Barron's pier. And Barron argued that this essentially made his pier valueless. It deprived him of his property in violation of the Fifth Amendment's Takings Clause, which says that no property shall be taken with public use without just compensation. Marshall asked the question whether this was a claim that could rightly be raised in federal court. And he said, no, it was not a claim that could be raised in federal court because the Fifth Amendment, and indeed the Bill of Rights generally, did not apply to state governments. In other words, the Fifth Amendment was intended to be a limitation on the federal government. And his argument here was that people at the time that the Constitution was pending before the states for their ratification had been worried that the federal government was being granted too much power. And so the Federalists, including in Virginia, where Marshall was one of the vocal Federalists in the convention, people had said, well, okay, we don't think you need to be worried about this new Constitution. We don't think the new government is going to take away your freedom of speech or your right not to have soldiers quartered in your house in peacetime, or your right not to have your house searched without a warrant, or any of the other important individual rights that people are thinking of. But in order to allay your fears, we promise that if you ratify the Constitution, we will see to it in the first Congress under the new Constitution, amendments along the lines of a Bill of Rights will be sent out to the states for their ratification. And then when the proposed 12 amendments were sent to the states for their ratification in 1789 by the first Congress, it included with those 12 amendments that it was proposing a preamble saying, well, the reason we're sending this to you for your ratification is that many people have been fearful of the idea that the Congress was being granted too broad powers, and so we want to put further clarification of the limits of those powers in the Constitution. That, then, was the conclusion that Marshall reached. People knew that the reason for this suite of amendments, of which I said before there were 12 proposed amendments in 1789, 10 of them were ratified in 1791, and we usually call that the Bill of Rights, and then an 11th of those proposed 12 amendments was ratified in 1992, 201 years after the first 10. An 11th amendment, drafted chiefly by James Madison, was ratified in 1992. Therein lies an interesting story, but not for the lecture on the second part of the Marshall Court. Anyway, Marshall then came to this conclusion. As usual, the court was unanimous, and this was the only significant case in which Marshall found against federal power.